At 4 p.m. on a hazy, humid winter's afternoon in Rangoon in November 1862, soon after the end of the monsoon, a shrouded corpse was escorted by a small group of British soldiers to an anonymous grave at the back of a walled prison enclosure. This enclosure lay overlooking the muddy brown waters of the Rangoon River, a little downhill from the great gilt spire of the Shwe Dagon Pagoda. Around the enclosure lay the newly constructed cantonment area of the port, an anchorage and pilgrimage town that had been seized, burned, and occupied by the British only 10 years earlier. The bier of the state prisoner, as the deceased was referred to, was accompanied by two of his sons and an elderly bearded mullah. No women were allowed to attend, and a small crowd from the bazaar who had somehow heard about the prisoner's death were kept away by armed guards. Nevertheless, one or two managed to break through the cordon to touch the shroud before it was lowered into the grave. The ceremony was brief. The British authorities had made sure not only that the grave was already dug, but that quantities of lime were on hand to guarantee the rapid decay of both bier and body. When the shortened funeral prayers had been recited, no lamentations or panegyrics were allowed, the earth was thrown in over the lime and the turf carefully replaced so that within a month or so, no mark would remain to indicate the place of burial. The Last Mughal by William Dalrymple. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to Season 10 of the Islamic History Podcast. This season, we are continuing our discussion on the Mughal Empire. This is episode 10-11, The Last Mughal. The Telegraph Comes to India. William O'Shaughnessy is the man most responsible for bringing the telegraph to India. He first arrived in India in 1833 as an assistant surgeon with the East India Company. But he was also a brilliant inventor. Some of his inventions include an electric motor and the silver chloride battery. He also did an experiment where he transmitted messages via electric shocks using the Hooghly River as a circuit. And he once demonstrated a telegraph system near Calcutta in 1839. Now, this telegraph system that he demonstrated in Calcutta was completely independent of Samuel Morse's system. If you didn't know, Samuel Morse was the American who first invented the telegraph and Morse code. William O'Shaughnessy's work did not generate much interest until 1847. That's when Lord Dalhousie became Governor General of India. Lord Dalhousie recognized the potential of the telegraph and authorized a 27-mile line near Calcutta in 1851. The success of this line led to the development of a complete trans-India telegraph network. This network was completed in 1854 and covered over 4,000 miles. The telegraph system connected Calcutta, Agra, Bombay, Peshawar, and Madras. The telegraph system helped to strengthen British control over India, and it would play a critical role in the Sepoy Mutiny. The Sepoy Mutiny began on Sunday, 10th of May, 1857, in Meerut, roughly 40 miles northwest of Delhi. As we discussed in the previous episode, there was already growing unrest amongst Indian Sepoys under British rule. But the British, in their arrogance, generally ignored the warning signs. For instance, some domestic workers warned British officers and their families to avoid church on that day. Also, several junior officers reported signs of unrest amongst the Sepoys. But their concerns were brushed aside by their senior officers. Well, it all started when the Sepoys freed their 85 comrades from prison. We discussed these prisoners in the previous episode as well. They had been court-martialed and humiliated after they refused to use these new Enfield rifles. And as we mentioned also in the previous episode, that's because they believed that the cartridges for these rifles had been lined with either pork or beef fat. Well, the British officers who tried to stop the prison break were shot, and then their houses were set on fire. From there, the sepoys traveled to Delhi. However, the British officers didn't bother to pursue them. Instead, the British officers, those who survived the prison break, they sent telegrams about the situation to the major centers throughout India. The sepoys entered Delhi and went to the Red Fort, hoping to get the emperor's support, that is, Emperor Bahadur Shah II. All the while, the sepoys were shouting, "Deen, Deen," which means religion, religion. Any British officers who tried to resist the sepoys at the Red Fort were quickly killed. The sepoys gathered in the Diwan-i-Am, that is, the public square, inside the palace. Initially, Emperor Bahadur Shah II refused to support the sepoys. He explained that he didn't have the army to support them, he didn't have the money to support them, and he didn't even have the authority to support them. Nonetheless, the sepoys continued to insist on his help, and eventually the emperor relented and agreed to support the rebellion. Meanwhile, the sepoys began attacking British houses and businesses in the city. Most of the British residents within Delhi fled the city, but before long, the revolt had spread across much of North India. Initially, at the beginning, the sepoys didn't have any formal leadership in this rebellion. But finally, the emperor appointed his son, Mirza Mughal, as the commander. Ironically, Mirza Mughal did not have any military experience. The days of Mughal princes and emperors and nobles riding into battle with their soldiers were long gone. Well, the British soldiers within Delhi took up a position on a forested ridge just outside of Delhi, and they were able to successfully resist all attempts by the sepoys to dislodge them from this ridge. Eventually, a man named Bakht Khan, who was a Rohila Pathan and a non-commissioned officer in the British EIC Army, he eventually arrived and brought order to the revolt. Bakht Khan was a non-commissioned officer because British policy excluded, well, British racist policy excluded the Indians from command positions within the military. One of Bakht Khan's first orders of business was to organize the revolt in Nemach, which is now in Madhya Pradesh. That's in north central India. Then he marched on to Bareilly, where he installed Khan Bahadur Khan as the leader there. We mentioned Khan Bahadur Khan in the previous episode. He was another Rohila noble who despised the British. Bakht Khan arrived in Delhi in July 1857, and the emperor appointed him as the commander-in-chief of the sepoy rebellion. Bakht Khan brought structure to the scattered sepoys in Delhi, and he also helped to re-establish military discipline, mostly through the use of regular parades and drills. Meanwhile, the British forces on the forested ridge that we spoke about earlier, just outside of Delhi, they were waiting for reinforcements from Punjab. Now here we can see the importance of the telegraph in suppressing the sepoy rebellion. Listen to this quote. "On a very hot day on the 10th of May, 1857, the telegraph office near the Delhi cantonment came alive. The message was from Meerut about the excitement of the Indian sepoys who were unhappy about the arrest and death sentence of some sepoys who had refused to bite the new cartridge. By the evening, the line to Meerut was severed, but the Delhi Telegraph Center, who got the first message, contacted Ambala, which in turn flashed the message to Lahore and other centers informing them of the mutiny. This gave the Englishmen at all stations enough time to disarm all Indian troops before the news of the mutiny arrived by messengers. In Calcutta, as O'Shaughnessy was away in London, and it was Shib Chandi Nandi took charge of heading the telegraph operations. The telegraph network was a significant weapon in the hands of the British to quell the Indian uprising. The message from Delhi to Ambala and onwards to Lahore ensured that the then Punjab, which controlled the majority of English troops, did not fall. Had it fallen, British India would not have survived." Rajiv Soni, The Telegraph and the Mutiny, Heritage Times, February 2024. Well, as we can tell from this quote, unfortunately for the sepoys, the mutiny in Punjab failed. That's because many of the Sikhs and Muslims in Punjab sided with the British. were British reinforcements from Punjab, led by Brigadier General John Nicholson, who was probably a psychopath, finally arrived in August 1857. The British launched a full-scale attack on Delhi the following month in September 1857. Their artillery targeted the Kabul and Kashmiri gates that led into the city. Finally, on September 14th, British forces fought their way into Delhi through these two gates. General John Nicholson, the psychopath, was killed in this fighting near the Kashmiri gate. For nearly a week, intense fighting raged through the streets of Delhi. And when the British finally reached the Red Fort, they found that it had been abandoned. Bakht Khan and the other sepoy rebels had already fled the city. Before leaving, Bakht Khan had advised the emperor to go with him to the Rohilla lands. His suggestion was that they could continue a guerrilla war against the British. However, Emperor Bahadur Shah II didn't want to do this, and he wasn't really into continuing the war at all. So instead, the 82-year-old emperor retreated to the royal cemetery near Humayun's tomb. Meanwhile, Bakht Khan and his sepoy troops fled to the Rohilla lands to continue the fight. The British eventually found the emperor at Humayun's tomb and arrested him, and they also captured all the princes hiding in the tomb's buildings. The arresting officer was a man named Captain Hodson, and some British later criticized him for not executing the emperor right there on the spot. However, the British did execute several male members of the emperor's family. His sons, Mirza Mughal, who was the commander-in-chief of the whole rebellion, and Abu Bakr, and his nephew, Qara Sultan, were stripped of their clothes and immediately shot. Then their bodies were publicly displayed, and their heads were presented to the emperor on a silver platter. Finally, their bodies were thrown into the river. One eyewitness, Zahir Dahlavi, reported that 30 princes were beheaded outside of Delhi. Their severed heads were also presented to the emperor. Then the British troops, along with their Sikh allies and other loyal sepoys, began to plunder the city, and the British committed massive atrocities. The rebellion was not only taking place in Delhi, it was also underway in other parts of northern India, including Kanpur in Uttar Pradesh, roughly 240 miles east of India. Nana Sahib and his Maratha commander, a man named Tatya Tope, were the leaders of the rebellion in Kanpur. Nana Sahib was the adopted son of Baji Rao. The rebels laid siege to Kanpur in June 1857, and after the British surrender, they were escorted to the river and then given boats to leave. But as the British were sailing away, the rebels fired on their boats, which resulted in many deaths. The British who survived this ordeal were taken back to Kanpur, where they were imprisoned in a former Bibi Ghar, which, as we mentioned in previous episodes, meant a woman's house. However, when British forces began making their way to Kanpur, all of these prisoners were then killed. Some of the most intense fighting of this rebellion took place in Lucknow, which is the capital of Awadh. Begum Hazrat Mahal led the mutiny in Lucknow. She hated the British for deposing her husband, Nawab Wajid Ali Shah. The EIC had accused him of mismanagement and used that as an excuse to exile him and take over Awadh for themselves. We discussed this in the previous episode as well. Now, Begum Hazrat Mahal proclaimed her son as the Nawab of Awadh, even though she was the one really in charge. Begum Hazrat Mahal accused the British of many things, some of them true and some not so much. For instance, she accused them of making Muslims eat pigs and drink wine. She accused them of forcing the sepoys to bite the greased cartridges that were offensive to both Hindus and Muslims, and this was kind of true. They did try to force them to do that. She accused them of mixing pig fat with sweetmeats. She also accused the British of destroying some Hindu temples and some Muslim mosques while also neglecting others. She also accused the British of building churches and sending their clergymen and the evangelists to preach Christianity to the Indians. She also accused the British of promoting their educational system over the traditional Indian system. While the British troops garrisoned in Lucknow fortified their positions within the British residency. The British residency was the home of the British representative to the Nawab of Awadh. On September 25, 1857, the British launched an attack on Lucknow. However, they weren't able to defeat the rebels, and instead, they wound up trapped within the garrison at the British residency as well. A second British relief force arrived in October 1857, and they were able to successfully evacuate the garrison on 18 November 1857. In March 1858, Sir Colin Campbell arrived with a Nepalese Gorkha army. He was able to finally recapture Lucknow on 21 March 1858. Nonetheless, many rebels escaped and continued to wage guerrilla warfare across Awadh. Begum Hazrat Mahal wound up fleeing to Nepal, where she lived until she died in 1879. Rani Lakshmi Bai was the queen of Jhansi, and she led the resistance against the British in Jhansi. Jhansi is located in modern Uttar Pradesh in north-central India. Initially, Rani Lakshmi Bai was able to successfully defend her territory. However, in March 1858, the Central India Field Force laid siege to Jhansi. The British forces eventually captured the city, but the queen managed to escape while in disguise. She moved to Gwalior in June 1858, where she joined the Maratha commander that we mentioned earlier, Tatya Tope. The British attacked Gwalior on June 17, 1858, and the queen, Rani Lakshmi Bai, was killed in the fighting. Tatya Tope continued the guerrilla war even after the queen's death, though he was eventually arrested and executed by the British in 1859. Why did the Sepoy Rebellion fail? I've often wondered why the Sepoys didn't win this rebellion, or if not win, at least why they weren't able to drag it out longer than the actual year and a half or so that it lasted. Or if not win, why weren't they able to drag out the fight for a longer period of time? You know, it only lasted for about a year and a half or so. After all, the Sepoys were trained soldiers and they had access to modern weapons, at least modern weapons for that time. But most importantly, they also outnumbered the British by at least 3-1. Well, there are many reasons why the British wound up winning in the end. First of all, the British had better technology. The British controlled the rail system, and they also had the telegraph network, and all of this allowed them to move troops quickly throughout India and communicate in almost real time. We can see that the telegraph was an important factor as to why the rebellion never really took off in Punjab. Another reason why the rebellion failed was that the Indian rebellion just wasn't well organized. The military commander in Delhi, Bakht Khan, could not coordinate with the rebellions in Lucknow or Awadh. These were all several, not necessarily independent revolts because they were connected, but they sprang up at the same time and they had no central command. Another reason why the rebellion failed was that the emperor was an old man and he was weak and his heart really wasn't into it. He was an older man and he did not have any true desire. He didn't really want to reestablish his ancestors' glory. Initially, as we saw, he didn't even want to have anything to do with the rebellion and he only gave in after the Sepoys pressured him. We can see his lack of enthusiasm in the fact that he didn't even bother to take part in the guerrilla war after losing Delhi. He just went to Humayun's tomb and waited for the British to come arrest him. Another factor that contributed to the failure of the rebellion was that many of the wealthy Indians did not support the Sepoys. The wealthy Indian merchants and the bankers and financiers, they profited from the EIC and didn't want to go to war against them. We can see this in that many of these wealthy Indians were able to buy protection from British retribution afterwards. The final reason why the rebellion really didn't work was that it mostly took place in North and Central India. southern and eastern India remained loyal to the British for the most part. Overall, I believe the lack of coordination between the various rebel hotspots, I believe that was the primary factor. This lack of coordination allowed the British to focus and defeat each hotspot individually. And once the British retook Delhi, from there, the rest of the rebellion really began to fall apart. Aftermath. Emperor Bahadur Shah II, his wife Zinat Mahal, and his son Jawan Baksh were imprisoned in the Red Fort. Meanwhile, since most of the rebel army had already left the city with Baksh Khan, the British focused their rage on the civilian population of Delhi. This was very similar to the French Revolution, where gallows were erected in Chandni Chowk. Chandni Chowk, which we discussed in Episode 2, is one of the oldest markets in Delhi. This was where Nadir Shah's sack of Delhi began way back in 1739. In 1857, the British began carrying out mass executions in Delhi. The British executed hundreds of civilians, nobles, and rajas. Now, many of those who were killed, who were executed, were actually participants in the mutiny. But many people were executed simply because they didn't help the British enough. Some significant executions include the Nawab of Jhajjar, the Raja of Ballabgarh, the Nawab of Farrukhabad, the Nawab of Dadri, and the Nawab of Ranian. Listen to this quote describing British retribution. "It was not just the royal family which the British were intent on arresting and bringing to trial. Most of the local landowners had sat on the fence throughout the uprising, and while attempting to placate both sides, had supported none. Nevertheless, neutrality was taken by the British to mean guilt, and one by one, the Nawabs and Rajas of Zafar's court were brought in, imprisoned, tried, and hanged. Ghalib's friend, Nawab Muzaffaruddaulah, was arrested in Alwa with two other leading Delhi noblemen and hanged near Gorgon. As the collector of the district said, there was no reason to send them back to Delhi, and so executed them there. The Shia leader, Nawab Hamid Ali Khan, who had left Delhi with Zahir Dahlavi's family, was hunted down near Karnal. Hakim Muhammad Abdul Haq, the agent of the Raja of Ballabgarh, and Nawab Muhammad Khan, Mirza Kirza Sultan's Mukhtar, who had commanded a wing of the rebel army at the two battles of the Hindun Bridge and at Bajli Ki Sarai, were arrested together in the territory of the Nawab of Jhajjar, and after being brought back to Delhi for trial, suffered the extreme penalty of the law on 25 November. The Farrukhnagar Nawab was brought in from his palace and turned out to be an opium addict, so that he suffered terrible withdrawal symptoms when his supply was peremptorily stopped under Omani's no-nonsense prison regime. He was later hanged. The Last Mughal by William Dalrymple. In addition to being hanged, many of the rebels were tied to cannons and blown to pieces. This was much more terrifying than hanging, and it was meant to terrorize the Indians. Even for those who were hanged, British officials demanded that the executioner do it in a way that the condemned suffered even more. So instead of dying from snapping of the neck, which is what hanging is supposed to do, they strangled to death as they hung from the noose. And as these men and women, mostly men, were hanging and strangling, their bodies would jerk violently, and the British called this the Dance of the Dead. The trials and executions were carried out throughout India wherever there had been any mutinous activity. Finally, the British forcibly evacuated the entire population of Delhi, and the houses of Delhi were raided as the troops looked for hidden valuables. However, British loyal subjects, they received guards to protect their houses, and some areas like Balimaran were spared due to the residents' contributions, for instance, doctors who had treated some of the injured Sikh soldiers. Also, as we mentioned earlier, wealthy merchants and bankers were able to buy protection. Both Hindus and Muslims participated equally in the Sepoy Rebellion. However, the British were much harsher in their punishment on the Muslims. and this helped to contribute to the long-lasting Hindu-Muslim divide in British India. Hindus were permitted to return to Delhi in January 1858, while the Muslims were barred from returning for an additional year. Furthermore, many mosques were converted into military barracks or sold to Hindus instead. The trial of Emperor Bahadur Shah Zafar began on 27th January 1858 and ended on 9th March 1858. He was charged with sedition and aiding the rebels, and it shouldn't come as a surprise that he was found guilty and sentenced to death. However, the sentence was commuted to exile in Rangoon, Burma. On 7th October 1858, the emperor left for Burma with his wife Zinat Mahal, his son, and several other members of the family in attendance. All told, a total of 19 people accompanied the emperor into exile. As he was leaving, crowds lined the emperor's path crying while British soldiers pushed them back to keep them away. The emperor's party reached Rangoon on 9th December 1858. Emperor Bahadur Shah Zafar, the last Mughal emperor, died in Rangoon on 7th November 1862. The Mughal dynasty began in the Valley of Fergana in the Central Asian mountains, and it ended in the tropical city of Rangoon, Burma. Bahadur Shah Zafar was an excellent poet. Here is an example of one of his famous works of poetry.
न किसी की आंख का नूर हूं, न किसी के दिल का करार हूं, जो किसी के काम ना आ सके, मैं वो एक मुश्ते गुबार हूं। मेरा रंग रूप बिगड़ गया, मेरा यार मुझसे बिछड़ गया, जो चमन खिजां से उजड़ गया, मैं उसी की फसले बहार हूं। जो बिगड़ गया वो नसीब हूं, जो उजड़ गया वो दयार हूं। पे फातिहा कोई आए क्यों, कोई चार फूल चढ़ाए क्यों, कोई आके शम्मा जलाए क्यों, मैं वो बेकसी का मजार हूं। न किसी की आंख का नूर हूं, न किसी के दिल का करार हूं।
Neither the light of anyone's eyes, nor the solace for anyone's heart, one which is of no use to anyone, I am that fistful of dust. My complexion and beauty is ravaged. My beloved is parted from me. Garden that got ruined in autumn, I am the crop of its spring. The one that is ruined, I am that fate. The one that is destroyed, I am that land. Why should anyone come to pray Fatiha? Why should anyone come to lay some flowers? Why should anyone come to light a candle? I am the tomb of that destitution. As for his sons, well, Prince Jawan Bakht, he died in Burma in 1889. Another son named Prince Abbas, he married a local woman in Burma, and he lived there until he died in 1910. Emperor Bahadur Shah II had 49 children. However, most of the descendants of the Mughal dynasty now live in extreme poverty. On August 2, 1858, the British Parliament passed the Government of India Act. This transferred the dominions of India directly under British Crown rule. The East India Company, one of the most horrific and terrible examples of corporate greed, was finally dissolved, and Queen Victoria became the sovereign ruler of India. The EIC's 240,000-man military was transferred to Crown authority and became the Indian Army. And this was how things remained until August 14, 1947, when the independent nations of India and Pakistan replaced British India. You can, of course, go back to listen to Season 4 of the Islamic History Podcast if you'd like to know more about that story. So with that, our journey through the story of the Mughal Empire, which began nearly 2.5 years ago, it now comes to an end. In the next and final episode for this season, I'll give some parting thoughts on this amazing saga of the Mughal dynasty, and we will also discuss what's coming next, inshallah, for the Islamic History Podcast. You've been listening to the Islamic History Podcast, and we hope you've enjoyed the show. You can support the Islamic History Podcast and get exclusive content by subscribing to our premium channel, Islamic History Exclusive. If you're an Apple or Spotify user, open the app and search for Islamic History Exclusive. If you're listening on Podbean, become a patron in the app and you'll get access to our premium content. You can also join by visiting patreon.com/Islamic History. I'd also like to thank Brother Zulfikar Sarosh for his research on the Mughal Empire and his continued support of the show. And thanks to all of our premium subscribers. Be sure to join the Islamic History Podcast Telegram group where you can download a copy of today's transcript. Finally, subscribe to the Islamic History Podcast YouTube channel for our video documentaries. Stay tuned for a short clip from the latest season of the Umayyad Caliphate. Until next time, my name is Muttaki Ismail for the Islamic History Podcast. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the Umayyad Caliphate Season 3, presented by Islamic History Exclusive. This season, we are discussing the years 96 to 105 AH. This is episode 3-11, The Death of Yazid II. Let's begin our story today by discussing the downfall of Ibn Dahak. Ibn Dahak had some friction with Fatima bint Husayn. Ibn Dahak was the governor of Medina, and we discussed him briefly in episode 7 of this season. Fatima bint Husayn was the daughter of Husayn ibn Ali ibn Abi Talib. Ibn Dahak, the governor of Medina, he tried to force Fatima bint Husayn ibn Ali ibn Abi Talib to marry him. So as you can tell from the name, Fatima bint Husayn was the granddaughter of Ali ibn Abi Talib radiallahu anhu. However, Fatima bint Husayn did not want to marry Ibn Dahak, but she was afraid to say no because he threatened to whip her son if she did not marry him. So while this was going on, Caliph Yazid ibn Abd al-Malik, way off in Damascus, he sent a message to Medina, to the governor of Medina, requesting a list of the registered men in Medina. This was for military and stipend purposes. So this would be considered the Diwan. He wanted to know what was the fighting force and what was the stipend requirements for the people of Medina. A man named Ibn Hurmuz was in charge of presenting the register, that is the Diwan, or the register of men, to Yazid ibn Abd al-Malik. But before heading off for Damascus with this information, with the register, Ibn Hurmuz stopped to visit with Fatima bint Husayn. Fatima bint Husayn asked Ibn Hurmuz to inform the caliph, inform Yazid ibn Abd al-Malik of what Ibn Dahak was trying to force her to do. Unbeknownst to Ibn Hurmuz, Fatima bint Husayn also sent a separate messenger with a letter to Damascus. This second messenger was also going to inform the caliph of the problem that Ibn Dahak was causing for Fatima bint Husayn. Fatima was hoping to use the family relationship between her and the caliph to encourage Yazid ibn Abd al-Malik to help her. Now, I tried, but I couldn't really find the connection where Fatima bint Husayn was related to the caliph Yazid ibn Abd al-Malik. Of course, they do share a common ancestor, that is Abd al-Manaf, but that was several generations ago. So just as so you can understand, Abd al-Manaf, he was one of the ancestors of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Abd al-Manaf had many sons. Two of them were Abd al-Shams and Hashim. Hashim was the great-grandfather of Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who in turn was the great-grandfather of Fatima bint Husayn. Abd al-Shams was the father of Umayyah ibn Abd al-Shams, for whom the Banu Umayyah are named after. They're named after this son of Abd al-Shams, Umayyah ibn Abd al-Shams. Umayyah ibn Abd al-Shams was Marwan ibn al-Hakam's great-grandfather. And as we know, if you've been following this this podcast for a while, Marwan ibn al-Hakam was Yazid ibn Abdul Malik's grandfather, because Marwan was Abdul Malik's father and Abdul Malik was Yazid's father, Yazid ibn Abdul Malik. Well, back to the story. Ibn Hurmuz and Fatima's messenger arrived in Damascus around the same time. Remember, Ibn Hurmuz, his responsibility was to bring the register of men to Damascus for the caliph. Ibn Hurmuz did not know that Fatima had sent a separate messenger on her own besides him. Ibn Hurmuz was called in first to report to the caliph while the other guy, Fatima's other messenger, was waiting outside. When Caliph Yazid ibn Abdul Malik asked Ibn Hurmuz about how things were going in Medina, he did not say anything about Fatima bint Hussein. And just as they were wrapping up their meeting, as the caliph and Ibn Hurmuz was wrapping up their meeting, the court chamberlain, the guy who makes the announcements, he announced that there was a messenger outside waiting to speak to the caliph from Fatima bint Hussein. And now all of a sudden, Ibn Hurmuz scrambles to inform the caliph of Fatima bint Hussein's plight. He starts stammering and trying to explain what was going on, and Yazid ibn Abdul Malik was livid. He was very angry with Ibn Hurmuz because he thought that Ibn Hurmuz was deliberately trying to hide this information from him. Of course, Ibn Hurmuz claimed that he forgot, but it was a little bit too late for now. So the messenger was brought in, and he gave Yazid ibn Abdul Malik Fatima's letter, and Yazid ibn Abdul Malik was already pretty upset. He grew even angrier after reading the letter. So he himself wrote a letter to the governor of Ta'if in the Hejaz. He wrote a letter to the governor of Ta'if, appointing him as the governor of Medina. And he told him that when he arrives in Medina, arrest Ibn Dahak, fine him 40,000 dinars, and torture him.